I'd like to talk, as the title says, about quadratic rigidity of rigid frameworks. And this is work that I've been doing over the last few months or so with Bill Jackson, who's also in the audience. And it is very much work in progress. So if you have any tricky questions, you direct them first to me. And if they're too tricky for me, I'll direct them on to Bill. Should start with a little bit of motivation. Why am I interested in the quadratic solvability of frameworks, whatever that may be? We have the usual definition of a framework, and the sorts of things I'm interested in, we're not given the coordinates in the first place. That tends to be the way people in this area think of frameworks. You're given a bunch of positions for the vertices. From those you can find the edges and look at the property of the framework. I'm interested in frameworks from the point of view of computer-aided design, which is solving equations, where often in a sort of an engineering design you would be given dimension values that drawings should satisfy, and you want to compute the geometries in the drawing that will satisfy those dimensions. That translates quite obviously into, if you had only points and distances, would translate into a framework, but you're given the distances and you want to compute the location of the points. So that's the kind of direction that I come at it from. And then there's the obvious question, given those distances, how do you compute the points? How do you compute some of the locations? Or sometimes how you compute all of the locations of those points? And in the language of frameworks and rigidity, that translates into looking at the inverse of the edge map. So that's really the area I'm interested in. And thinking at it from the point of view of equations, the edge distances define a set of polynomial equations in which the coordinates of the points are variables. And so the problem is really a problem of solving equations. If the graph is minimally rigid, then we sort of have just about the right amount number of equations to define the points, and that is typically the sort of environment that you have in an engineering drawing. Probably you don't want it to be too over-dimensioned, and so that does translate into what people in framework language call isostatic frameworks. But there are a lot of engineering circumstances where you do need to have redundancy. I mean, a very simple example is if you take two objects and you want to bolt and you want to bolt them together. You drill two holes in them, you put a bolt through one hole, and if you want to line the other two bolts up, the two distances have to align, otherwise you won't be able to get the bolts through. So even in a very simple example, you very often have redundancy in the sort of equations that you want to solve to generate realizable configurations. So I have been looking more recently at frameworks which are not minimally rigid, but have redundancy in them. Then you have an issue of how do you choose your edge distances, because if you take a redundant framework and just, if you take an isostatic framework, broadly you can choose a set of distances, roughly speaking, at random, and you'll find a framework, if not a real framework, at least a complex framework. But if it's redundant, if you take a set of arbitrary edges, your framework will typically have no realizations. So you'd like to really start in an environment where you do have some realization to get started on. So that leads you to sort of look at the reverse problem. Start, which sounds a bit bizarre, but it's start with a set of points, compute the edge distances, and then look at the property of those points that you started with, given these consistent edge distances. So that's the kind of way we're going to look at it. So we start with the framework. We use the framework to define a consistent set of edge distances, and then ask about the property of the solutions to the equations with those edge distances. So my initial framework is really just a nice device for getting points, for getting distances that satisfy my distances. I'll just make the comment, equations are almost always most easily understood in complex variables, so it's very natural to let our frameworks be complex. And Bill talked about this at the end of last week for people who were here. I'll just go briefly over it just so that people that weren't at Bill's talk will know what I'm saying. this leads us to the idea of complex frameworks. So almost everything, almost all the properties that you have for what I will now call a real framework that we're used to, translate into complex frameworks. But I just want to be a little bit careful about what I mean by a complex framework. It's a map, exactly as it is for real frameworks, from the set of vertices into C2 now. Normally, well, I'm mostly going to talk about things in the plane. So for a real framework, we have a map from the vertices to R2. I want to think about a map from the vertices to C2. So the first thing to say is, it's not a map. I'm not mapping the reals onto the complex plane. I'm mapping the coordinates of my vertices into complex numbers. So frameworks are complex vectors. So a framework point still has an x and a y component, but each of the x and y components are both complex numbers. And so then now a framework defines a set of edge distances. It's just the sum of the squares of the differences between the coordinates that the edge connects. So for every edge in a graph, which represents the framework, I have a set of distances. And if I happen to take real points in my as my point coordinates, then the distances will be real. But if I happen to take complex, my complex numbers have an imaginary component, then the distances will simply be imaginary numbers, or will be imaginary numbers. And so really that's just the way you would naturally go from the reals to the complex. There's nothing fancy about this at all. You have exactly the same issues in the complex frameworks that you have in real frameworks. You have all the isometries, all that just goes through. You want to get rid of the isometries. You can get rid of them in just the same way. So in almost everything that I say, I'll be considering pinned frameworks. This is not really essential, but it's convenient that I can get systems of equations that have finite number of solutions. So I consider pinned frameworks, and I'll say that a pinned framework is normal if I take the coordinates of one vertex, V1, and I put that at the origin, x is 0, y is 0. So here means the real part is 0 and the imaginary part is 0. And this one means of the x-coordinate. This one means the real part and the imaginary part of the y-coordinate is 0, just as you would expect. And then I make the x-coordinate of a second point 0 and leave the y-coordinate free. So that's how I'm pinning my framework. The reason I do it this way is it leaves me in the realm of algebraic geometry. I haven't introduced any inequalities. Everything is just an inequality. I've specified that the couple of coordinates are 0. So I then comment this takes care of most of the congruences, but not all of them. I've still got the reflection congruences left in. So when I've put down my framework in this normal way, I've still got 4 reflections. And when I've pinned down a framework, or indeed before I've pinned down a framework, I've got a set of edge distances. I can define an equivalent framework as being a framework with point coordinates, which gives me the same set of edge distances. That's just like you do for real. That's those frameworks we would say are equivalent. I'd say framework G, X of P is equivalent to G of P if the edge distance set that you get from the framework with coordinates x is the same as the one you get with p. I've called the coordinates of my second framework x rather than q, which is sort of more normal than I often will do, just to emphasize the fact that I often want to think of these as variables from the point of view of equations. And so that I'll often call them my equivalent frameworks gx. And that's my definition of an equivalent framework. And now I can say that a framework is complex. I can now look at the set of all frameworks which satisfy this equivalence relation. So given one of these, my initial one, I can look at the set of all frameworks which have equivalent edge distances. And I'm going to say that my framework GP is complex rigid if that set is finite. That's obviously a perfectly natural definition. That's the definition I'll use for a rigid framework, a rigid complex framework. And I can also have a definition of a rigid complex being globally rigid rather than just rigid. In that case, I would require that the size of this variety of equivalent frameworks have size 4. And the reason for 4 is that I've got, well, the way I've pinned it down, I can reflect the framework either in the y-axis or in the x-axis, and I've got a congruent framework. So in this, with this way of pinning things down, global rigidity equals 4 distinct solutions. No magic in this, it's perfectly natural. I don't, sorry. That's right. I don't pin the Y point, I think, yeah. Yeah. I've pinned both coordinates of V1, but I've pinned the X coordinate of V2, but not the Y coordinate. But yeah. I can flip all the other ones in the framework, as long as I've got more than, provided I have more than more than 2 points, I can flip. The flip, I'll get this right, right, that's right. The flip in the x-coordinate will leave P2 unchanged, but will take all the coordinates of all the other points to the other side of the y-axis. Pin the two coordinates. If I've got a this one could be I've made his x value 0, so without changing any distances, this one could go down here, and then I can also do this flip. I could, well, I can't, if I pin that one, and then I don't, how do I pin that one? I may not know its value. I should say I don't insist that V1 and V2 are joined by an edge. If I could do, I'd just square root the length of that edge. But that just adds a quadratic that I didn't tell you about, so it's pointless. And also, for some proofs, I want to be able to pin a framework by two vertices that aren't joined by an edge. Okay, so that's how I set up my framework system. Now, quadratically solvable frameworks. Well, given a framework vector P, which is a complex number, this defines an extension field over the rationals in a perfectly obvious way. But if I compute the set of edge distances, they also define an extension field over the rationals. Now, I make the fairly obvious comment that I can't get to that screen, that the field defined by the extended by the edge distances is contained in the field extended by the point distances, because to get the distances I just take some square formulae in the P's. That means that's in that field. That's what you can do in fields. So I know that the field which is extended by the distances is contained in the field that's extended by the points. So I've got an extension field. That's an extension of fields. The Q of P is bigger than that one, it contains all the points in its extension field. And I can ask about the nature of that extension, and that's what Galois group theory of equations does for you. I'll try and keep it simple. We can just say that a framework QP is quadratically solvable if this extension is a sequence of degree 2 extensions. And what that means is that I can, any point in QP can be defined by solving a sequence of quadratic equations which will have coefficients in the distance field. And that's exactly what I want from the point of view of solving, basically. If I had that property and I knew how to compute that extension, then I would, given any set of, roughly any set of distances, I would easily be able to compute my points. So this is a very desirable property if I can have it. I just make the comment, I won't talk about much, but as long as in addition to having quadratic solvability, you can define the related concept of radical solvability. And indeed, you can more generally just look at the Galois groups of these and consider them. Just moving on to generic framework, generic properties, which is a rather convenient thing to do. We say that a framework is generic if this point coordinates are algebraically independent over Q. We have the usual concepts with complex objects, frameworks that we have with real frameworks, complex rigidity, complex global rigidity, quadratic solvability, radical solvability. Now it's relatively easy to show that these are all generic properties when viewed as complex frameworks. And really it just comes down to the fact that there's an isomorphism between the algebraic closures of these fields when P and P prime are generic. So that's a relatively easy thing to get hold of, which contrasts with the case of real frameworks where some of these can be slightly slippery concepts. So this means that I can define complex rigidity, complex global rigidity, quadratic solvability, radical solvability as just properties of a graph corresponding to generic points. This is not the main point of my talk, but just one quick slide. For any graph, we have almost certain, we have real rigidity equals complex rigidity. I think this is relatively easy to see, but there is a question as to whether real global rigidity equals complex global rigidity. We know it from what I'm about to say, we know it does for D equals 2, and I think this is what Bill showed, that these are true for D equals 2, but we don't know, it's not to me clear whether these are equivalent for all D. It's quite an interesting question there. This is just repeating what I've said, except I would like to emphasize something I'll try and get to at the end if I have time. We would say if a graph is quadratically solvable, then we can start with any set of consistent edge distances and compute usually one and usually all frameworks which satisfy those distances. There is a question, I think, over starting with any set. Certainly we know we can solve a generic set, but there is a question over any set I'll try and get to at the end, because that relates to specialization of non-generic frameworks. Quite an interesting subject in itself. For now, we can just ask which graphs are quadratically solvable, and if a graph is quadratically solvable, is there a good algorithm to compute the solution, if you like? So just draw a few graphs, some small ones. These are quadratically solvable graphs. This one, and this one are isostatic, and these are the ones that Steve Power and I looked at some time ago. It's relatively easy to see that these graphs are quadratically solvable. You just have a sort of a sequence of constructions for them. This one's just the intersection of a fixed two base vertices. This one's just the intersection of two circles, obviously. This one similarly. This one's slightly more interesting. This one's quadratically solvable because you can split it up. If you imagine separating it at these vertex separation sets, you can compute the subgraph on the left, then the subgraph on the right, and then piece the whole thing together. So there is a kind of recursive element to this quadratic solvability that you have to get hold of. It is more than just Penenberg simple. There's a recursive element. This guy is quadratically solvable, well, for many reasons, but basically you've got this as a subgraph. If a graph with one edge removed is quadratically solvable, if you put another edge in, all you can possibly do is take away some solution, so it's bound to be quadratically solvable. You've basically got more elements to play with. It's relatively easy to say that all complete graphs are then quadratically solvable. Essentially, the point of this talk is to show that this guy's quadratically solvable and this guy's quadratically solvable. So as you go outside the class of isostatic graphs, they actually get easier and easier to solve quadratically. So that's rather a nice property. So maybe it's more useful to look at graphs that aren't quadratically solvable. And it turns out that all graphs on six or less vertices are quadratically solvable, except the two we already knew about, except the two isostatic graphs. The first one that's not quadratically solvable is this one I've written, shown down here with seven vertices. And in a sense, you notice that's got rather trivially from the isostatic one, just by dressing up one of the rigid subgraphs and making that redundant. So in a sense, the quadratic non-solvability-ness is still obvious in this graph, and it turns out that's the only way that you get, quadratic non-solvability. It's essentially in isostatic graphs, you can throw edges in all the way until the point that you become redundantly rigid, then you become quadratically solvable. So in order to demonstrate that, I just want to introduce the concept that I think Bill and Tibor and perhaps others introduced for real frameworks of globally linked vertices. So we'll say that two vertices in a graph are globally linked if the distance, if their edge distance is the same in all equivalent graphs. In fact, I actually don't even need the graph to be rigid for this, definition, but I can say that that's my definition of globally linked. Now, when I think a problem with this in real frameworks is it's not a generic property, but for complex frameworks it is a generic property, it's very easy to see. And so that's my first point, global link is a generic property. The second thing is, I've called it a theorem, it's quite powerful but really relatively easy to see. If two vertices are globally linked in a graph, then their distance is simply in the field of the edge distances. And what this says is that if the vertices are globally linked, I will have a rational expression for that distance. I don't have to solve any polynomials, take any square roots. There's just a rational expression for that globally linked distance, given the distances in the graph. And that's relatively easy to see. It comes sort of fairly directly from algebraic geometry, really, because I can add in the distance between my globally linked vertices as a variable. I get an algebraic variety which is whose projection onto that distance is finite because it's globally linked. There's only one point in it. That means that that distance obeys some polynomial in the edge distances, because you just look at the elimination ideal. And the fact that this projection has only one point in it tells me that that polynomial must be a linear polynomial, because if it was a quadratic polynomial, I'd have two solutions. Every one of those extends to a solution of a complex framework. That's why you need the complexes, so you have that extension theorem. And so there would be more than two. There would be more than two possibilities for that edge distance. So I know that for globally linked vertices, the distance, their edge distance, is in simply in the original field. So just as an example to see how this works, if I take this graph, the dotted edge is not an edge, that's the red vertices are the ones I want to show are globally linked. Now if I look in the upper half part of the graph, I know that there's an expression for x in terms of the other distances that I've called R1 up to R5, because that's a K4 and that's a dependent graph. There's an expression, and it comes from a Cayley determinant, and it's a quadratic expression for x. It's a quadratic expression for x in terms of these the distances in the upper part of the graph. I have a similar expression for x in the lower part of the graph, so I have two quadratic expressions for x. Now I can multiply the top one by a sub s and the bottom one by a sub r, subtract them. I get a linear expression for the distance s. And that's exactly the way it works. You use the redundancy essentially to reduce the degree of the polynomial right down to the point where you get a linear. And so you know that globally linked vertices can be computed without solving any polynomial equations. So that raises two questions. Can we recognize globally linked pairs of vertices in any rigid graph? And the answer to that is yes, in on the plane, at least. That's part of our work. We can recognize that as a combinatorial property. Then a deeper question, but maybe more significant, is can we find a formula for computing this quantity for any globally linked vertices? And that seems to be much harder. And there are certain subclasses of graphs which we can get formulas, but I don't know of any general way of getting that formula. I'm running out of time. Moving on to global rigidity, the main point. The main point of my talk, actually, just getting there, is if a graph is complex globally rigid, then it's quadratically solvable, and that just comes from this property with the globally linked vertices, because in a globally rigid graph, every pair of vertices is globally linked. Kn is quadratically solvable, so therefore the globally rigid graph is quadratically solvable. In order to investigate quadratic solvability in general graphs, I want to be able to reduce things to three separated graphs. Like we did in the isostatic case, we can do that generally. If I have a two separation of vertices, that is to say there are edge sets, so the graph splits into a G1 and a G2, that defines two separate subgraphs, G1 and G2. I'll define a subgraph H1 and H2 by adding an edge to G1 if G2 is rigid, and adding an edge to G2 if G1 is rigid, otherwise leaving it alone. You see the logic of that, because a rigid graph induces a distance into the other graph. And now I have the fact that G is quadratically solvable if and only if H1 and H2 are quadratically solvable. So this essentially allows me to reduce the problem of finding whether a graph is quadratically solvable or not through the problem of looking at just three connected graphs. And on the way, I get a theorem that if G is an R, if the rigidity matroid is connected to G, then G is quadratically solvable. Did I say that right? So three connected graphs. We can determine if G is quadratically solvable by determining. Okay, I just said that. So some time ago, 20 years ago, in fact, I had a conjecture for isostatic graphs that G is isostatic. If G is isostatic and three connected, then it's not quadratically solvable. So if this conjecture is true, we will have a complete characterization of quadratically solvable isostatic graphs. Steve Power and I have proved this when G is planar, but we still can't prove it when G is non-planar in general. In fact, one of the motivations of this work is perhaps considering widening the class from isostatic graphs into general rigid graphs might give us a chance to prove this theorem conjecture for non-planar graphs. But what I can show you now is that if we could prove that conjecture, then we would have a complete characterization of quadratic solvability for all rigid graphs, because I have a theorem that these three statements are equivalent. If G is isostatic and three connected, then G is not quadratically solvable. That was our original conjecture. That is equivalent to: if G is rigid and three connected, then G is quadratically solvable if and only if it's globally rigid. So it gives us quite a nice connection between quadratic solvability and global rigidity for three connected graphs. And then there's a third equivalent statement: if G is rigid and three connected, then G is quadratically solvable if and only if it's redundantly rigid. And that comes from the work of Beal and Barb and other people showing that those two statements, two and three, are equivalent. It's quite convenient, this. I put three down because it's the one I want to use, just to give a sketch of how we show that those things are equivalent. So we want to show that if a graph G is three connected and rigid but not redundantly rigid, then it's not quadratically solvable. So here's my graph, which is three connected and not redundantly rigid. That means that there's an edge such that G minus the edge is not rigid. Yes, that's right. If G is not redundantly rigid, then there is an edge such that G minus the edge is not rigid. And that's the property I want to take care of, because then I can take that edge out and split. Consider G. Well, then G minus E will then define a set of rigid components within G. So I take the edge out, use that to get the rigid components, and then put the edge back in.